let's get cracking, shall we then? Cue the music and go.
Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, a podcast about films, music, television, anything else that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe, the erudite chap, in the last week or so.
Oh, you say the sweetest thing, Simon.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're not going to have too many sweet things to say, I don't think, about Inferno, which is the latest, and oh dear lord, we do pray the last, in Dan Brown's interminable cash cow of a series with Robert Langdon.
Yes, we'll have fun with that one. We'll also be talking about The Girl on the Train. That's the new Emily Blunt mess with your head mystery thriller. And also, I've been to see the disaster movie called Deepwater Horizon.
Indeed, and I've been to see Skyscraper Stan's tour opener in Pukekohe.
Well, looking forward to hearing about that one. But let's start with some film. And Steve, you were, shall we say, a touch dismissive of Inferno just a moment ago. Would you care to elaborate on that?
I thought it was quite generous, to be perfectly honest. Look, we have to do this, don't we? I mean, I've been trying to put this out of my mind since we saw it. I think people by now know the basic setup of any Dan Brown film with Tom Hanks wasting his talents as Robert Langdon, the semiotician who goes off exploring these hidden mysteries that people have left scattered around various interesting parts of Venice. Yes. And there is something of a story. The story this time is something to do with a killer virus that's been planted by the absurdly named Bertrand Zobrist, some philanthropist who wants to kill half the world.
I know, when you say it out loud, you think,
Yes, you think, seriously, I saw this film? It's absolutely dreadful, it really is. It's the usual thing of people who know all about something, experts. I mean, this particular case, it was experts on Dante.
Yes,
telling each other about Dante. It was exposition to the camera and little else. Tom Hanks really should know better.
He should. I guess he was well paid.
I would hope so. How much does a soul go for these days? I can think is he opened up the script and it said scene one, Florence. We thought, okay, fair enough. Nice place. I'll go for a holiday. Because I mean, his career is clearly on a holiday at this point. I mean, he knows better. Ron Howard, someone needs to have a word with.
And here's the thing about that, because I actually, just the last time we were talking, I quite enjoyed the work he did on a documentary, mind you. He was the one who put together that Beatles documentary that we talked about last time, which I actually thought was quite good. But you're right, in this case.
I know, and a couple of weeks ago, we were praising Tom Hanks for his work in Sully.
Yeah. Well, so, it just goes to show, it's the material.
The whole is clearly significantly less than the sum of the parts here, isn't it?
Look, I just found it, Steve, so convoluted as to be almost unintentionally funny.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
And other times, I hate to say this, I was actually bored at other times because you just knew it was just going through this, doing the dance that the previous films had done, and some of this, you just feel like it's a deja vu. Tom and another attractive young woman are running from place to place, trying to beat the clock. Robert Langdon never gets into fisticuffs, so I suppose that's one interesting aspect of this character that's been concocted, but it just seems like a rerun.
Yes.
With a more outrageous plot to hang it over. One thing, though, there was one character whose performance I did quite enjoy. I don't want to be completely negative, but the actor Irfan Khan, I thought he did a good job. He was playing.
Cool. Let's see how you can explain this character, because I still don't know quite what the deal was here.
I would say is he's a character who starts out being an out and out bad guy, and turns out to be not quite such a bad guy, and you end up actually, I ended up quite liking him in a sort of a way, because he so was relishing his part and adding something to it.
I get the feeling he was. I mean, he's listed on IMDb. The character is the provost. He's the head of some sort of shadowy, semi, not underworld, sort of extra national entity that sort of pulls strings around the world.
Yeah.
It was vaguely smirchish, if you want to get a James Bond reference in there. We're not quite sure what the deal was.
Yeah.
But, and you're never quite certain whether he's on the side of the angels or the demons, to get in a quick Dan Brown reference, although God knows why we want to. And he's the only person who figured that he was going to have a bit, who realised how preposterous the entire thing was and thought, let's just have some fun as we get through this.
I think so. I think that's a very good point. He looked like he was having a bit of fun.
Yes, he did.
And I'm
glad somebody was.
I really appreciated it, because the other characters didn't look like they were having much fun.
No, were you?
No, I have to say I wasn't. And I was going to say I felt sorry for Tom Hanks, but I don't, because I think he is a good actor, and he's a very accomplished actor, and he just, I don't know. I mean, the only thing, if you hadn't been to Florence or Venice or, was it Istanbul?
Yeah.
You might enjoy the scenery. And if you didn't know much about Dante and some of the other art history aspects of this tale, you might get a little bit out of that. But it's just clunkily put together. The plot is outrageously silly. And you end up laughing when you really where you shouldn't be laughing. That's what I thought.
Well, you're right. I mean, you say that you'll learn a lot about Dante. And I mean, some of the exposition, the expository dialogue is, you know, clunky is being generous. Do you remember this one scene when Tom Hanks as Robert Langdon, and it's Felicity Jones this time, is his attractive female sidekick playing Dr. Sienna Brooks,
yes,
who, by astonishing coincidence, just happens to be a fellow Dante buff.
Who would have thought?
Who knew there was such a thing in the world?
Yes.
And they're walking through, I guess it's St. Mark's Square, isn't it, in Venice? And Langdon turns to Dr. Brooks and starts telling her about the fact that the word quarantine comes from the sailors who were kept offshore.
Right.
And you think, okay, that's interesting. That's very interesting. I'm glad I've learned something tonight. But what on earth was the point of putting that little piece of monologue in there?
Yeah.
You could just hear it going clang. It was no. It was just a mess. And at the end, you know, one thing that kept coming to mind, and we're going to talk about this a little bit more when we dig into The Girl on the Train shortly, is a good thriller, a good mystery, should sprinkle clues that an observant viewer will be able to pick up on, and certainly at the end you'll go back and go, oh, right, yeah, okay, I see that. Yeah, I can see the breadcrumbs now.
Yeah.
Everything was so utterly arcane. Unless you're familiar with Dante's Inferno, and every single verse within it, you're not going to have the faintest idea what's going on. And you're going to have to trust them that what they're saying isn't complete gibberish.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You just have to, you're right. You have to trust them and hope that it's almost like it's a veneer of sophistication, and you're not quite sure if that's an ultra thin veneer or not, you know? It's like it's trying to persuade you that this is really a classy piece of work because of all this classical reference. And maybe it isn't.
That's beautifully cynical. I like that perspective an awful lot. It's all surface, isn't it?
Well,
it looks like it should be brilliant, and yet scratch the surface and you realise it's completely and utterly preposterous.
Mm-hmm. Preposterous is a good word. It is preposterous. So I don't know. I'm not sure what else I could add to that. There was one interesting thing, because I did read... The Da Vinci Code way back. I'm not sure if I read many other Dan Brown books, but I don't know if you have, Steve, but the Robert Langdon character in this film, they do address something about why he's been a single man all this time.
Because he's so crushingly boring and tedious that no woman will be with him.
So they do try and do a bit of backstory for you about this former relationship that didn't quite work.
But even that backstory, you can poke so many holes in it. I mean, I've seen fishing nets that have had fewer holes than this.
Anyway, you've been warned. You've been warned if you want to go watch this one.
There you go. Crave is a public service.
That's right.
We see these films, so you don't have to.
That's right.
Can we move on, please?
I would say to the very important question, would you buy a ticket? I don't think I would. In fact, I know I wouldn't.
I mean, you don't think that there's doubt in your mind, is there, Simon?
No.
You're willing to entertain the possibility that under circumstances you might.
No, I don't. If you had said to me beforehand, Steve, because of Tom Hanks and because he's done some quite good work lately, like Sully and one or two others as well, I probably would have thought about it because of him.
Yeah.
But that would have been. But then I would have also thought, but I've seen one of these other movies before, and nah.
The only possible thing it's got going for it is goodwill toward Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, and quite frankly, the pair of them frittered it away.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Anyway, that's that. No, don't go.
Please move on? Please, let's move on. I'm begging you. Please. Where should we go next?
There we go. I put The Girl on the Train.
The Girl on the Train. Absolutely. This is the new Emily Blunt, isn't it?
It is. I think we might have different views, so this should be a good chat. I mostly thought this was pretty good. Just to give you, now this is a whodunit. It's a thriller. Now it's based on a book. So if you've read the book, The Girl on the Train, this was written by the British author Paula Hawkins. So if you've read the book, you know the story anyway. But assuming you haven't read the book, and I had not read it, so the plot was new to me. This is it's a very dark story. It is a whodunit. The girl on the train is a character called Rachel. She's played by Emily Blunt. She's a divorced woman. She's haunted by her failed marriage. She's practically crippled by alcoholism. And she's part of this very tangled, but I actually thought relatively well explained, you might disagree, but well explained web of relationships. She's got her ex-husband, Tom, his new wife called Anna, their nanny, who's Megan. So those three women are central to the story. Rachel, who's Emily Blunt, Anna, the new wife, and the nanny, Megan. Those are the three sort of central female characters. And then you've got also, well, as part from the husband, Tom, you've got a therapist, and you've got another husband. So there's a few men in there, but it's kind of a woman's film, or the women are the victims, I suppose you'd say here. I guess the key thing is Rachel, the girl on the train, sees an incident. Did she witness a foul deed, or did she actually commit one? And if you've seen the trailer, you'll see that that's where the question that this film is asking, this whodunit. It is complicated. It's quite layered. It jumps around in the timeline a bit. I mostly found it quite compelling for most of it. I was prepared to go along with where it was taking me. I thought Emily Blunt was really good as the tortured Rachel, and I thought the other characters did well. It's difficult. We have to be careful not to give away a whodunit, of course, in a discussion like this, Steve. But just before we get to the end part, did you enjoy the first part as it was taking you along, as you were riding the train, or not? Because I quite did.
I have a tiny bit of a confession to make. We've ranted in recent episodes about the practice of certain cinemas to pad out running times. Yes.
Yeah.
But with interminable trailers. So I actually rocked up to my local cinema here in Pukekohe a few minutes late. They've obviously taken our comments to heart, because I think I must have missed the opening couple of minutes. And I can think is there must have been somebody lined up the characters one and explained one by one, this is Rachel, this is Megan, this is Anna, and here's how they interrelate. Now off you go. Because I must have missed that scene. I'm assuming it was there. Because
the first
hour made no sense to me.
Oh, no. Okay, so it had quite a bookish feel, actually, at the beginning, which I think was quite effective. So you hear Rachel as she's introduced, then you hear Anna as she's introduced, and you hear Megan as she's introduced. So I thought that was – I didn't mind that. I agree it did jump around quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm led to believe that jumping around the timeline, and it does bounce around quite dramatically. I'm told that was kind of a decision made by the director Tate Taylor to try and reflect the muddled way in which the alcoholic character Rachel manages to construct her memories, because as you say, she's a almost completely dysfunctional individual, and this is their way of reconstructing or depicting a dysfunctional alcoholic's attempt to reconstruct her own life.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. I mean, what did you think of Emily Blunt? I quite like her, but...
I thought she was a little bit one-note, to be perfectly honest. She dialed everything up to 11, There's no.
That's true.
I mean, the anguish oozed out of her. You can tell this is a very, very troubled woman who's dealing with deep, deep problems in her life.
Yeah.
And there's not much else you can do with a character like that. It was a one-dimensional character who was pretty much defined by her alcoholism and her clinging onto the wreckage of a marriage that had ended.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. I thought she grappled with her part really, really well. I mean, it's a pretty dark story. You've got alcoholism, you've got betrayal and deceit. I would say, without giving it away, there's an inherent violence under the surface of the story, and there's one physical act of violence, Steve, that when I saw near the end, I actually almost had to turn my head away. I was quite.
It was a tough watch, wasn't it?
It was a tough watch, yep. And I noticed other people around near me were sort of doing the same.
Yes.
But my main – so I actually thought as a dark, noirish thriller, I thought this was mostly pretty good. And I would have – I'd say, you know, especially if you don't know the story, I'd recommend it. But I've got a but, though.
Go on, then.
This is what you just talked about with a couple of minutes ago. I think for a whodunit to really work well – when you get to the end and you get the reveal, you need to feel that the character who's the responsible one for the crime, you've been given a little bit of a hint as to, or a little bit of a clue as to how they've been involved. And so you can say, oh, wasn't that clever writing? There was that clue. I didn't pick it up.
Yes.
Or they've done a good job.
Yes.
I don't think they did that in this story. I think when I finally got to the part where I realized who the responsible person was, I couldn't think of any clue that would have led me there. So no. I felt I felt deceived. I felt I'd been cheated a little bit, that all of a sudden we are revealed completely different aspects of this person's character that we had not even been hinted at. So
I think that's a really good point.
How would you have picked up on that? I wouldn't have picked up on it.
You weren't supposed to go back and say, oh, right, of course, yes, there was this and there was that.
Yeah.
And as you say that, I saw this film last night, so it's still fresh in my mind. I'm going back through and thinking, no, there really wasn't, was there?
There wasn't. And so it is clever in the sense that when they get around to putting it together, you can see the construction, and that's all well and good, but you just wouldn't have. Yeah, I just thought that's not a good whodunit. Would Agatha Christie have done that? I don't think so.
No, but she did sort of like have great big signposts all the way. But this is to be fair the other end of the the spectrum, isn't it? Now, yeah. One thing I thought was challenging almost in a way. We mentioned that Rachel is clinging on to her memories of her marriage to Tom.
Yes.
And then there are two other women involved in the story who are involved with each other in a way. We don't want to give too much detail because it's a fairly intricately connected interplay between these various women. Hayley Bennett plays Megan, who is the babysitter for Anna, who is Tom's wife and the mother of Tom's child. Yes. And Anna is played by Rebecca Ferguson. And the two women have to my mind at least, a more than passing similarity to each other.
Yes,
it
that's
wasn't
true.
Always entirely obvious who you were dealing with at any given moment.
Was that possibly intentional?
I'm sure it was. I mean, Rebecca Ferguson is not a blonde, and yet Anna is. So presumably a decision was made to make Anna and Megan look like each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. There is one scene where you see a blonde woman from the back, and yes, I recall it's partly hidden. It's a scene in the forest, and you think it's probably one of them, but you think, oh, maybe it's the other one. So that's interesting. By the way, just very quickly, I think Hayley Bennett was the female lead in The Magnificent Seven. Is that the same woman?
Emma Cullen, yes.
Yes.
I had the same experience. I spent much of the film going, now, who does she remind me of? And at the end of the film, I came out and I asked my wife, and she said, yeah, she looks just like Jennifer Lawrence, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does.
I had the same experience.
Anyway,
worth mentioning, however, I think we should point this out, Hayley Bennett and Rebecca Ferguson, both exceptional performances.
Yeah, I think so. I think the actors all did pretty well. I think Hayley Bennett, actually, that role she played of that the babysitter, the nanny, there was a lot going on with that character.
Yes, there was.
And boy, I think she delivered that very, very, very well. I mean, I think you'd go to see the film to see some pretty good acting.
Yes.
You may or may not share my view about the end, but I would still recommend it because I think it's generally a pretty classy piece of work. It's certainly well, it looks good, but yeah, the story is had a bit of a question mark. Well, not a bit. It had a large question mark in the way it in the denouement. Is that the word? The denouement.
That's the one.
Yeah. So yes, I would buy a ticket, but I'd just be ready for something interesting.
I hear reservations. I hear the books.
A slight
in your
reservation.
Voice.
I don't want to say don't go and see it because I think I would recommend it.
Yeah.
But yeah, just be ready for something a little interesting at the end.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair summation.
All right then, here we go.
Now, Simon.
Yes.
I know we thought that Inferno was a complete disaster.
Yes.
But was it? It wasn't a disaster movie.
No. Oh, that's you're a clever lad.
You see what I did there, didn't you?
Yeah, you're wonderful. Yeah.
Been working on that one for weeks. ever since I nearly fell asleep in that film. Now, speaking of disaster movies, you've been to see Deepwater Horizon. Now, disaster movies, very much a thing of the 70s, weren't they? You remember like Towering Poseidon, whatever it's called, and all those, right?
Towering Poseidon. That's right, yes.
We've gone from Inferno to Towering Inferno. The connections never end, do they? Bit like
You should be writing a film script. I can feel it.
Well, I would do a better job than Inferno.
Yeah, you would.
Sorry, I'm sorry. Anyway, we need to put that aside and we need to talk about Deepwater Horizon.
Yeah, we do. This is interesting. I went into this with some mixed thoughts. I saw the trailer. The trailer looked quite good, I thought. This is a pretty recent disaster. The Deepwater Horizon, of course, is that BP floating drilling rig that suffered a terrible disaster in 2010, where it caught on fire. People's lives were lost. It was made headlines around the world. There was environmental disaster that went on for months and months and months. This is the story of the initial disaster. It's not the story of the all the environmental concerns that arose later. So this is about the people who worked on the Deepwater Horizon, how they all go to work one day and it all just falls apart. There's a terrible tragedy on board. So I think we should be just clear about which part of the tragedy this film deals with. I think it's pretty good. It's certainly it treats the story with some seriousness and respect. It uses the voices of some of the actual people involved to introduce the beginning of the film.
Oh, okay. But it's not a doco, though, is it?
It's not a doco, but at times it gets close to a doco drama feel.
Oh, okay.
With the use of graphics and timelines and whatnot. It's and I think because they've clearly consulted the people who were on the rig, they've done a pretty good job of constructing the feel and the mood of the workplace. So you have quite a lot of sparring between workmates and some quite nice humour. You know, the feel of it is quite authentic. So I you feel like you're in a not a, a cheap attempt at something. You feel like you're involved in a film which is taking this quite seriously. So that was good. So the story is mainly told through the experience of a guy called Mike Williams, and he was a chief electronics technician on board the rig. He is played by Mark Wahlberg.
Now there's a name, the character, an actor who's sort of like reinvented himself quite nicely.
Yeah, I'm interested to know what you think about him. I've seen a few films in with him. I'm not convinced he's the world's greatest actor by any means. He seems to me to tend to focus on sort of working class heroes, which is exactly what he plays in this film. What's your sense of Mark Wahlberg?
I get the feeling that he's very, very much found himself a niche.
Yeah,
I think he knows what he was. I mean, you know, let's face it, he came from a really dodgy boy band back in the 1980s. You know, he was, let's never let him forget the fact, he was a new kid on the block. No, wait. I'll tell you. Sorry, that was Donnie Wahlberg. What am I talking about? That's his brother.
Oh, no, his brother. Okay.
No, he was Marky Mark from the Funky Bunch, wasn't he?
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, right.
Yeah. Let him forget this.
Okay. All right. So yeah, that's interesting. So he is a very well known face, and again in this film he's playing, well, yes, a working class hero, and the emotional part of the center of the film, if you like, comes from him and his relationship with his wife Felicia, that's Kate Hudson, and his daughter Sydney, who's a young girl called Stella Allen, the actress. But the actual, I'll come back to Mark Wahlberg in a second, but basically you've got the real drama and the tension here is between the oil rig chief, the guy in charge on board. He's Mr. Jimmy, and Mr. Jimmy is played by Kurt Russell and played very well. Gruff, he's gruff and he's gritty, and he wants to look after the safety of all his staff on board. I think Kurt Russell just chomps through this role. And on the other hand, you've got the BP man, Donald Vedrine, and that's, I thought, a very nicely pitched performance from John Malkovich.
Oh, right.
So what the scenario we're presented with as Mr. Jimmy and Mike, that's Mark Wahlberg, and they start the new shift, and they get on board, and uh-oh, they're a month and a half behind schedule. They haven't got to the finished the drilling they need to drill. BP are pressuring them to get on with it. Mr. Jimmy finds out that there's a critical safety test that has not been fully carried out. He wants it done. The BP guy doesn't. He wants to just get on with the actual getting the oil out of there, and everything unravels and unfolds from there. So that's the setup, and it's really that. It's the workers versus BP, which is the actual tension here.
Right.
And they do that pretty well. I think they've got some two very senior and classy actors who do that. And actually, to be honest with you, for me, I was more drawn into that conflict than I was with the slightly more touchy-feely character of Mark Wahlberg's, to be honest with you, because I think he's almost a bit too nice. That would be my one, everyone loves him. He's a devoted father. He's a devoted husband. He's
right.
Good at his job. There's not much light and shade there. He's just a good guy with a capital G. It's fine, but it's he wasn't who I was necessarily caring the most about. But the director is this guy called Peter Berg. Steve, he was an actor way back in the TV actor years ago, and he's done a bunch of movies, and I think he does a good job. I think it works very well. But the actual disaster is well constructed and directed. It looks spectacular and scary. Apart from that quibble about Mark Wahlberg being a bit too nice, the only other thing I thought was a little minor quibbles for me. I don't know how you are deciphering the Southern American accent, Steve, but it can be quite a drawl, can't it?
Remember, this incident took place very close to where I used to live.
Yeah, because you were in Florida, weren't you? And this is just along the coast in Texas. And I just thought there were a couple of times at the beginning when they're rattling through the technical explanation of what's happened with this test on the concrete.
Yeah.
I kind of got a bit lost with it. I have to say it was just partly the speed and the accent and the technical frames. I got the big picture, but the detail, I had to almost put it to one side.
No, that sounds reasonable.
But that's a relatively minor point. I mean, they explained that you basically know that there's a safety test and it wasn't done. That's what you have to know.
Yes.
I guess they were very mindful of the fact that people had died and that they obviously had consulted people on board in the making of the film. And so you do have this sense that, you know, all those on board, all the workers were just fantastic, fantastic people, and all the BP people on board were just, you know, the bad guys. And that's a little bit black and white.
Yes.
But I think that's a relatively minor quibble. I wouldn't take them to task too much for that because it was emotional and deeply felt terrible disaster.
The question that keeps coming to mind as I'm hearing you telling the story of this is, had this not been a true story, would it have been half as interesting?
That's interesting. Probably, maybe not. because if it had not been a true story, they probably would have tried to concoct some sort of other conflict on board,
yeah,
to give it more bad guy, good guy thing, or have some other sort of evil, dastardly character running around, or something, because you know where it's heading, and you know also at the end of this film that there's a lot more of a story that's still to unfold. So that's where it does have that slightly docudrama feel, but in a way, I think that makes it feel more authentic and makes it feel like you've been treated with a certain amount of respect as the audience. No one's trying to pull the wool over your eyes that, you know, this is the end of it. This is something that's going to unravel for months to come.
Right.
So I thought this was pretty good. I thought it was pretty good. I would definitely recommend it. It had the feel of a sincere attempt to tell the story. Some good actors. The actual disaster itself is pretty excitingly, tragically, but excitingly depicted on film. And there's you found yourself caught up in it. So, yep, if you haven't seen it yet and you're into this sort of thing,
buy a ticket.
Go get a ticket.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So, lots of movies, but not all movies this week, Steve. Because you and I, a month or two or three ago, we saw a bunch of musicians rehearsing, didn't we, in Auckland?
We did.
For that tribute to David Bowie. And one of the chaps we saw was a guy, I remember him, because A, he was tall, and B, I remember him singing Young Americans in rehearsal.
Yes.
And I thought he was a pretty interesting character, and I think you've got quite a liking for this guy. Tell me more about Skyscraper Stan.
Skyscraper Stan is a quite an interesting chap. He's Australian-born Kiwi, Stan, yep, Woodhouse, who's now based in Melbourne, and has put together a band called Skyscraper Stan and the Commission Flats.
Yes,
they've been touring extensively around Australia over the last couple of years. He's done a couple of concerts over here in the last year with his cousin Oscar Herbig, who's a quite talented guitar player.
Right.
The two of them do a great show together as a duet. But this year, he's brought his whole band, the Commission Flats as a whole,
yep,
over for a rather extensive tour of New Zealand. And they opened in Pukekohe last week, which is unusual.
Yes. They must have known that's where you were.
They must have. Word got out clearly.
Yeah.
So I had the good fortune to see them last week, and I'm awfully glad I did.
Good.
Well, we'll work in a quick clip of some of their show at the end of this review.
Good.
But what I will say is they were brilliant.
Great.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah. And what sort of, I mean, tell me about the band. Was it a guitar-driven band, or tell me more?
It's very, very hard to pin down, to be perfectly honest. Stan has a very relaxed vocal style. He's a lovely singer to listen to. As I say, Oscar, his guitarist on electric guitar, drives a lot of the songs, stands on acoustic guitar. We've then got drummer and bass player behind them. And the whole thing just worked. It's folk rock is how they describe themselves. And they're also wrapping up the Americana Fest at the Tuning Fork next to Vector Arena tomorrow. So that's kind of how they're pitched, is troubadour rock and roll, I think is how Stan describes the band.
Well, that's quite nice.
Yeah.
Nice phrase.
It's just a really, really entertaining night out. Also of very great interest is their support act was a band called Ravens.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the Eastern.
I've heard of the Eastern, but I'm not familiar with them.
Folk band out of Littleton.
Okay.
And the three ladies who form Ravens have all been members of the Eastern. In fact, we saw one of them, Reb Fountain, was one of the backing vocalists in the David Bowie tribute, Waiting in the Sky.
Right.
And so the three of them, Jess Shanks, Alice Ryan Williams, and Reb Fountain, play together as Ravens. And absolutely brilliant. Lovely. So it's, again, hard to describe. I was talking to Reb Fountain before the show, and she mentioned the fact that Jess Shanks plays banjo, and she mentioned it almost as a threat. Like, you need to be aware of this. You need to brace yourself. And I don't, she'd already mentioned that the Alice Ryan Williams plays fiddle. And so I said, oh, so you're bluegrass. And she almost flinched at the mention of the word bluegrass.
Yeah.
And no, that's not who they are.
Okay.
But there is blues, there is country, there is rock in there. They say there's a little bit of the spirit of punk to their acoustic folk music. Okay, we'll put a video on the website so you can see for yourself. Really, okay, really entertaining music. Like I say, you've got three lovely voices. You've got some rather almost aggressive banjo playing. You've got some lovely blues country fiddle. The whole thing just worked fantastically.
Good
and then
stuff.
After they played their half-hour opening act, then Fountain and Williams came back on as the backing vocalists for Stamp. You don't even want to talk to me, it's over. I know, but I can't let go. Unfortunately, the New Zealand tour is wrapping up as we record, so I don't know when there'll be another opportunity to see them. But if you hear this before they play at the Tuning Fork on Sunday in the evening as part of the wrap-up for the Americana Fest,
right,
get yourself there because they were really, really entertaining.
Okay. Hey, just quickly, has Skyscraper Stan put out much in the way of albums or CD or whatever?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. The album that they're promoting on this tour in New Zealand has just been released in New Zealand. It's called Last Year's Tune,
okay,
which is kind of appropriate, really, because it was actually released last year in Australia.
Okay, very good. Okay, yeah. So if you can't get along to see them live, it might be worth picking up the album.
I would strongly recommend it.
Oh, good stuff.
If only for my personal favourite track, Woody Guthrie. Is a lovely, lovely song to listen to.
Oh,
highly, highly recommend.
Oh, good stuff. Songs we can't finish this week, Steve. I must just ask you. News just came out yesterday about Bob Dylan getting the Nobel Peace Prize for Literature.
Yes, that's kind of odd.
Have you been a fan of his writing?
I've never really thought of him as a writer.
Oh,
I've always thought of him as being a slightly whiny and nasally folk singer. But as long as there is no Nobel Prize for slightly whiny and nasally folk singing, then I'm not quite sure why he qualified.
Oh, that's interesting. We wouldn't see eye to eye on that. I shouldn't have raised this without perhaps having a few pages of Bob Dylan lyrics in front of me, and I don't. But I think he's concocted some pretty interesting lyrics. I mean, he's had all these different phases, you know, from the early period to the rock period to his Christian period and beyond, but I just think it's kind of interesting. It's an interesting part of where popular culture has got to, hasn't it, Steve? That someone who's been doing this for decades, something like the Academy, the Nobel Academy, can look back at all that and say that actually does represent a contribution to literature. That in itself is kind of interesting, I think.
I remember a couple of years ago having this discussion on the panel on Radio New Zealand. We were talking about some academic was trying to say that music lyrics were the modern day literature,
right?
And I remain unconvinced. Even though at the time I did mention that on the back of the Queen album that contains a song, Tie Your Mother Down, I think it's the Sunday Times in London described the lyrics to that song as sheer bloody poetry.
Oh, there you go.
I remain unconvinced. But we've given a Nobel Prize in literature to the man who wrote Everybody Must Get Stoned.
Yeah, that's true, but he wrote lots of other things as well. He's probably written hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs. So,
but you yeah. can't beat a good cherry pick, though, can you, Simon?
No, you can't. You can't. Okay. All right. So, hey, look, there's actually quite a bit coming up pretty soon, isn't there, Steve, film-wise and music-wise?
There's actually quite a bit coming up in the very near future. We've got the preview of Doctor Strange coming up in a week or so.
Yep.
Which has the potential to be either utterly brilliant or absolute twaddle. We'll hold judgment on that.
Yes.
There's Ouija, the new horror film. I think we can probably predict the storyline of that one just from the one-word title.
Yes, yes.
Tom Cruise has made another Jack Reacher film.
Yeah.
We'll see where that one goes.
Yeah. Yep.
And then in music, a couple of new concert tours have been announced for early next year. Culture Club and Barry Gibb. There's names from the past for you.
They sure are.
Both of whom are going to be coming to Vector Arena in the autumn. There's full details on the website at cravepodcast.com. You get full details of those two dates and ticketing information. And also Justin Bieber.
Oh, you'll be rushing out for that one, won't you?
Contain your excitement, Simon.
Oh,
I know. apparently, tickets are going for up to $600 for that one.
Yeah, holy smoke.
I'm saving up my pocket money as we speak.
Oh, deary me.
Yeah, I mean, he's now playing Mount Smart Stadium.
Yeah, 600. That's a pretty hefty ticket.
Yeah, he's playing Mount Smart less than a month after Bruce Springsteen does.
And Bruce's tickets, by the way, are about a third of that price. At the top end, there are tickets much more. But anyway, that's just by the by. So, well, I want. Yeah, interesting. Hmm. I think you mentioned there's a bit of heavy metal coming around the corner as well.
Yes, that's going to be about 2 weeks from today. Slipknot, who again, on the other end of the spectrum from Justin Bieber, to be fair.
Oh, and then some.
Very theatrical, very, very heavy metal.
Okay.
Are going to be on at the Vector Arena. And that's going to be on the 26th of October, the same night, incidentally. Not music, but still a live performance, and probably, in its own way, even more entertaining. Bill Bailey.
Yeah, doesn't he have a ukulele or something?
Yeah, we could shoehorn him into music, can't we?
I think he seems a very likable rogue.
Yes, he's highly entertaining. I've seen him in a number of things, from Black Books to QI on British television.
Yes,
and he is eccentricity personified. But highly, highly entertaining.
Yeah. Good. So, well, there'll be quite a bit for us to chat about the next time we get together, which will be quite soon. Look, thank you very much for listening. We've got to rush off and get on with our busy weekends. You know, we are men about town. Thanks for listening. And if you want to listen again or check out our website, look, we're very pleased to hear from you. Actually, you know what, Steve? I was thinking it would be quite nice to hear from someone who's read the book,
yes,
The Girl on the Train,
yes,
and can tell us about whether, you know, how well the film adaptation handled the transfer from the written page to the film. So, you know, drop us a line. Cravepodcast.com is where you get to us.
Absolutely. You can find us on Facebook also, obviously, or you can follow us on Twitter at cravepodcast.
Fantastic. So, I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.